Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, listeners. This is Wes Roberts sitting in very briefly for Leslie Mitchell-Clark. Tonight we're airing a pre-taped episode featuring Captain Randy Kramer. This is his first visit to the Contact Show and his first Canadian on-air interview. We're very proud to air this interview in its entirety tonight. We did have a couple of technical difficulties 2 weeks ago. So please sit back and relax this special edition of Contact with Captain Randy Kramer.
To talk about. And so I love my siblings, but they don't want to talk about it, and so we're not talking about it.
Okay.
Yeah. We're not talking about it, so I don't know what's up exactly with them because they're not talking.
Oh, boy. Well, also not unusual, but I would... You know, I would imagine that there is some involvement there, but certainly.
I'm not going to get into it, but there are some signs. You know, there were. My older brother was experiencing post-traumatic stress disorder symptoms. You know, when he was like 4 and 5 years old, and was actually, fortunately got into a program that the university nearby was doing that was getting a grant to do this sort of child welfare thing. And so they were able to really like look into these children's lives individually and investigate what was happening and try and really come up with sort of full spectrum programs to assist, you know, whatever, you know, their developmental issues were. And so he actually had like a crack team of university smart people who were really trying to help him and sort his youth out. Mm-hmm. And I think just all the evidence of that, because I've read, my mom still keeps all that, has all these documents of what I've read, is that he went from being a really, really amazingly bright, squared away little child to a post-traumatic disorder acting out child overnight, sometime between, you know, about 4 and 5 years old, and that everything from that point is all symptomatic and reflective of what post-traumatic stress disorder symptoms would be. And I can sort of, what I remember coming along later into life as he was a bit older than that and sort of seeing what was happening in his life could pretty much be demonstrative of someone who had their life really interrupted by something that they couldn't deal with.
Yeah.
So, and I love my brother to pieces, and he's, you know, he's okay as far as what, you know, he lives a decent life at the moment now, but I don't think he's dealing with whatever has happened in his childhood either, you know, whatever I think did or what actually we all know did for sure.
Yeah.
But yeah, no one's really talking about it or dealing with it, but yeah, I think there's plenty of evidence to suggest that stuff was going on. But
yeah,
you know, love them to pieces, and when they want to talk about it, they know I'm here.
That's right, and that's all that can be done. That's all that can be done. And Randy, now I believe you said that your recalled experiences, or maybe you had partially conscious memories, I'm not sure, but they began quite early, again, a very typical scenario at around, you know, 3 or 4. What are the earliest encounters, or what was the nature of them that you are able to recall that pertain to this this entire program that you've been involved with?
Well, you know, adult reflection on that period of my life has been really interesting, because I've certainly been able to look back at it through a different lens of perception, where I think at earlier points in my life when I attempted to really sort of delve back into the memory of my youth and my childhood and try and sort out, you know, what was all going on in there, mostly all I could do was come away with more question marks than anything else, because there were just too many unanswered questions to understand what all these memories jumbled together meant. I kind of had to separate things into two categories, which were the things that I absolutely knew for sure had happened, and then all the other things that I couldn't be absolutely sure happened and maybe were just because I had a really vivid imagination. And so I, as an adult, I can look back on all of that. And when I say look back, I don't mean just, you know, sit back and ponder. I do deep, you know, meditative states to recall childhood memories and childhood experiences, to sift through all this stuff kind of on a regular basis. So it's kind of part of my diligent work to go through all this crap. I can say that the reflection, looking on it through the lens of what I understand to be true now, has been very, very, very illuminating. And what I can say is that I knew from day one of any experience that I was having, whether, you know, being picked up and abducted or being visited in the middle of my room, I was completely aware that these things were happening. I was just framing them in the ways that a child's imagination could frame them, and in a way that I just never accepted as, oh, this is a really a thing that's happening here, not just something that as a child between sort of dream state that I'm having some kind of vivid imagination about. I can say now for a fact that I was well aware of what was going on, and I was well aware of what was happening, but as a young, tiny child, you know, you're talking when it was really starting to be aware of being taken out and doing training programs, it's like, yeah, about 4 years old. So 4, 5, 6, 7, these are really a young age of development to try and figure out who and what you are and what's happening in your world, to thrust something that completely foreign to your experience or what anybody or what you think anybody else and even around you is going through, and trying to process the disconnectivity of the experiences that you're remembering when you wake up in the morning, and trying to jumble them all together and separate them out and say, well, did I dream that? Or I don't know, that felt really real. Yeah. You know, I was breathing pretty hard and my heart was pumping pretty hard, you know, like it's, that felt really visceral. Like I was, the sweat on my brow, you know, was dripping into my eyes. I mean, there's these certain visceral things that I just don't think are the same as most dream states. Right. And I certainly now, as an advanced meditator and experiencer of the mind, I can say that there are really distinctive qualities of essence between dreams, visions, theta states, memories, fully immersive memories, you know, five, you know, when you're experiencing all the senses in a memory, you know, that these are really qualitatively different experiences in the mind as far as shade, texture, color, definition, and what I would say are also sort of applied laws of physics, is sort of what can happen in those states, how the sort of, you know, physical lines of objects are defined, how the sort of palette of colors that are used, as well as these sort of sounds and visual cues that represent these, I would say they're just very qualitative. It's a list of qualities that make those states just exceptionally different from one another when you've had enough of them. And so I can really say I know the difference between having a fully immersive memory experience, sensory, you know, full sensory memory experience versus, you know, oh, I dream of something or a vision of something or, you know, future vision of something, which can all, which has a certain quality too, but it's not the same as a full sensory immersive memory experience. So I would just say that, yeah, you know, having dug through all of that, and knowing the difference between all of that and looking back through all these childhood experiences, you know, now through the filter of understanding, yeah, I was really knew what was going on the whole time, but I didn't know how to process it into reality. So I just kind of felt that I had this, I was creative and I had an imagination, and that part of me was just living in this other kind of fantasy world, you know, a child's imagination world that I felt that I was living in. That was not that at all. It was a completely real and legitimate world. But it, to me, I just had to quantify it and qualify it that way so that I could kind of get through my normal day. And then I just otherwise didn't have any way to sit down and talk to anybody about it other than, you know, to say things like, hey, I had this dream, you know, and know that even though I was saying I had a dream, that I wasn't necessarily talking about I just had a dream, but that's how I had to frame it. And I certainly learned at a very young age that if you frame something the wrong way, grown-ups would give you that look of concern, the kind of concern that make them want to maybe go see you, have you t- talk to doctors.
Yeah.
And when concerned doctors talk to children, you get this feeling that this is not a free environment to talk freely, that you're under a kind of microscope, that you're going to get judged. And like, is this the thing that's going to put you in a home or a hospital or, you know, under further observation? Like, this isn't just a, hey, we want to know what's going on so we can know what's going on and help you. Like, there's a real serious, like, area of judgment on what you say and whether they're going to put you somewhere or decide that you need medication. And so I certainly understood that it was to my benefit that whenever adults gave me that concerned look, that I not talk about that thing or frame that thing or put it in a way that then they would not give me the look of concern that they could, you know, be okay with that. And as long as they just kept saying, boy, you sure do have a vivid imagination, Randy, I could say, oh, yep, I sure do. And I could be fine with that. But it was, yeah, I was pretty, you know, I was aware of what was happening. It was just not in any way that I could put in a straight line and that I could sit down with someone and say, oh, hey, by the way, you know, I'm being taken out of my bed in the middle of the night and going to do military training. I'm not really sure what it's all about, but just thought you'd know, so you don't worry. I mean, there was no way for me to verbalize that, not to mention that as I got older and realized that when I did kind of think about it, I wanted to talk about some of these things that happened, that there was literally mechanized programming that would clamp down my vocal cords and I would literally lose the ability to make speech. And so that was something that was really bizarre and took some time to get over because even in the early stages, sort of in my late 20s, when I really was starting to want to talk about it, and I was finding like the literal freezing of my vocal cords and inability to make words and sentences in trying to verbalize to someone. I mean, like you want to scream something at someone. You really want to say it, and you literally cannot, and it's not like you're frozen with some kind of anxiety or terror, like something is just clamping your vocal cords and you can't make speech.
Yes.
It's the most bizarre thing in the world. but I know other people who've experienced that, so
oh,
I know it's not me, but yeah, it's a totally bizarre and freaky thing to experience, but it's also just like getting your dog collar yanked too.
Yeah.
And in some way it's like, that's a kind of slavery that we shouldn't be okay with when someone's getting their collar yanked like a dog, but they're a human being, because human beings don't, you know, get choke changed. That's not okay.
No kidding. And in fact, even what you're talking about can even occur in deep hypnosis, where a subject will say, they're not letting me talk about this.
Yep.
That,
yep.
I mean, I can have the person in a hypnotic coma practically,
yep.
And those suggestions, those neurological hookups are to a certain extent still operating.
They're stronger. They're stronger to resist than your ability to make them talk.
Yes.
That is what I learned.
They're stronger than anything benign and healing that I can do, because this stuff comes from another kind of technique and technology. I'm very convinced. And you know, Randy, I'm sure that, you know, we talked a lot about, I mentioned post-traumatic stress disorder earlier, and I'm sure that what we're dealing with here is a very specific type of post-traumatic stress disorder that is beyond anything that you will see individuals who've been to Vietnam or Afghanistan experience. It's a multi-layered, and I think some of it is time-dated. In other words, I think some memories are allowed to be expressed while others may not be. But we're really starting to look at this as I wouldn't consider myself a scientist on that level, certainly, but with the real-time mapping of the brain, they're understanding what's going on with individuals who are recalling and remote viewing, and we're getting a handle on this, I really believe. Now, Randy, when you had your experiences, particularly as a little guy, and on into adolescence, were you engaging in this military program? Were you engaging with humanoids primarily? Were there hybrid beings involved, or etheric beings involved? What was going on?
The primary interaction was with other human beings and military personnel, but there were certainly the involvement of a couple of different species in my case, in the program that I was built under and trained under. So it was a cooperative program in that sense, that our military personnel, in order to do this program with a level of precision and scientific accuracy. They were going to need help from some extraterrestrial scientists who would give them a hand at this, and who I can sort of say, knowing a thing or two about them, are experts in this field, and expert at genetic mapping and engineering and time mapping people's lives and things like that. So that was a cooperative effort between our military personnel and these extraterrestrial personnel who were able to give their expertise so that we would actually not be rusty rust buckets, but, you know, smooth, streamlined machines, as it were. But it was not, we did not have a lot of contact with extraterrestrials at the young training stages at all. In fact, it was mostly preferred that we had human-on-human contact, and most of our extraterrestrial contact was very peripheral, in the sense that we would see our leaders and human leaders talking to them often at a distance, and then coming back to us and talking to us. And so we kind of knew there was a relationship, and it was a friendship, and it was friendly, because they always seemed to have these, you know, cordial, friendly interactions, but we never really got to hear what they were saying or understand what the conversations were about. So it was really just more like this peripheral understanding that, oh yeah, there are these ET guys over there, and they talk to your grown-ups, and it's kind of okay. So I think that was a bit of a slow acclimation thing, so that we would be acclimated without being overly shocked about it, because I still think that there is a certain acclimation that the human mind has to make, and it's okay that we have to make that acclimation. I think the excuse that it's too much of a shock is not an excuse. I think that we just have to get over it.
Yeah.
That's the answer is no. Even if it's shocking, we got to just get over it and get on with our lives. But understanding that there is an acclimation process, though, is totally reasonable. And understanding that people will have individual acclimation process is totally reasonable. And so I don't always try to remember to say this, but for everyone out there who knows what time it is, as far as, you know, exopolitics are concerned, at some point, your friends and family members are going to need help in understanding all of this, and they will turn to you when you're no longer the freak or the black sheep when everyone's talking about it. Then you'll be the person that can explain it to them. So just try and be good and patient explainers, and realize that a lot of people you're going to be explaining this to soon enough are going to really not just be acting like they're hearing it for the first time. They are hearing it for the first time. They've been living in little dark spaces where they haven't heard a word of this. So, you know, be patient with them, and, like, you know, just be willing to understand that they have an acclimation process too. So be patient with your friends and family when it comes to time to explain.
Excellent thought there, Randy. Now, folks, if you're just tuning in to Contact this evening, we are speaking with Captain Randy Kramer, a.k.a. Captain K, who is speaking about his experiences in a parallel space program in the Mars Defense Force and the Lunar Defense Force. And one thing I wanted to ask you about, Randy, and now you mentioned this in a program that I listened to some time ago, and it has to do with the, you know, the dark agended grays. Like, I think there are many, many beings, and I had observed, or my colleagues and I have observed, that the instances of sort of aggressive grays conducting their, you know, genetic research or whatever the heck they've been doing, that these types of experiences have somehow really come to a halt. We really don't see this past a certain period of time.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that you talked a little bit about how you as part of the Mars Defense Force, were able to put the kibosh on some of this activity by a military action on one of the moons that these negatively intentioned Zetas were inhabiting.
So history of the Zetas kind of goes like this. They were one of the first species to make a deal, and it just turned out within a pretty short period of time that we realized that was a bad deal. And we've been looking to try and figure out how to get out of that deal ever since. And it took a number of decades of developing our own very sophisticated space fighting force with spaceships that have powerful weaponry on them, and advanced weaponry and advanced bombing and advanced targeting systems and all of the advanced technology that you need to deal with when you're fighting other spacefaring beings who have advanced technology. Who, I want to point out that sometimes people talk about, well, how do you fight beings that are thousands of years ahead? Well, sometimes they're not that far ahead, and we've made incredible leaps as well, and there really is just kind of a there's a bar, you know, and most spacefaring species hit that bar and don't really go too super past that for a really long time because they kind of got everything they need at that point. And so there's a plateau of sort of technological development when you got most of it down and your civilization can kind of thrive in that zone for a little while. So really it's there may be people who have more advanced technology than we do, but we're now up to that bar where most of the intergalactic species who want to come into our neighborhood, we have the right and the ability to tell them that we don't want them here or not. So over time, as we developed our more powerful fighting force and continued to tell them that we didn't like the contract and we had undid it and we weren't going to let them abduct people anymore and they needed to stop this and stop that, then we started, you know, saying more firmly, no, we really, really mean it. No, we really, really mean it. And then, okay, now you're not allowed here anymore and we'll shoot you down if you enter our airspace. And then it's like, okay, now you need to leave the solar system. You need to, you're evicted. And then it was like, no, we're not leaving. It's like, yeah, you are. And they're like, no, we're not. It's like, yeah, you are. It's like, no, we're not. And then you say, yeah, you are. And then we bombed him and made them go away. No, I understand. I mean that, like, diplomatically, there was back and forth. You know, it wasn't just like, get out of here, and then we blew him up. It was really, you know, some time of, no, really, we mean it. We're serious. We'll push, you know, we'll fire upon you. We'll shoot you down. And, you know, a lot of these sort of, you know, stages of diplomatic and military action where, you know, you have no-fly zones and you're containing, you know, them and their base around Ganymede and saying, look, you need to leave here. We're not letting you fly out. We're not letting you get supplies in, you know. Where, you know, essentially you hold a seat, you know, like, you know, when you an old, what I used to call them, when you're seizing a castle, but I'm drawing a blank at what the word is for medieval wartime technology, but you surround it and you're basically, you starve them out, you fight them, you basically you wait them out. And so we kind of did that with a long time and saying, look, we're not letting things in, we're not letting things out, you have to go, we'll give you time to organize and go somewhere else. And they just kept saying, no, we're here, this is it. And we're like, okay, fine. And then, you know, we blew them up. So, yeah, and when I was in the EDF on the Nautilus, which is not a Mars Defense Force program, but when I was on the Nautilus, yep, we were in one of the fighter air wing units that got to blow them up. So, yeah, that was fun.
All right. Good for you, Randy. All right.
One for us. Yeah, so I want to make it perfectly clear that we may not be, you know, the toughest bunch of hombres, you know, in the galaxy, but we can totally hold our own now. And so people who we really have a level of security and defense over what's coming in and out that we didn't have 10 years ago.
Oh, that's excellent to hear. And Randy, now when you were, you know, a teenager and you'd passed through all of this this training, and I imagine they were stimulating the various genetic upgrades that you've had in various ways, Was there a point of accountability where you were asked, you know, do you want to continue, or do you want to go back to just a third density life? Did you have a choice at some point, and when did you really get on board as a full-time military unit?
That's an interesting question. I don't think anybody's ever asked me that before. The answer would be yes. You know, there certainly was a metaphysical playing field for this and for my experiences through this. And there was certainly an opportunity when, you know, I feel like I was, you know, really pulled out of my physical body into, you know, a sort of in between dimensional space, and had some kind of serious conversation about, okay, you're really serious about this? You really want to do this? Is this really what you want to do? You know, and we'll send you back. If not, then, you know, you can be done right now. And it was just kind of like, no, yeah, I'm going for it. Let's we're a go, let's do it. And so, yeah, no, there was a moment of where that was a choice, and I certainly made the choice to do my mission. So
okay. And when you actually left, I guess, in the physical sense, were you being transported to Mars in a large vehicle of some a large spacecraft of some kind, and were there hundreds of cadets, if I may use that term, with you, or was it a small number?
So the ride from the Earth to the Moon was in a standard TR-3B Black Manta Black Triangle ship that's made by Northrop. And that's a, you know, maybe like a 90-minute flight usually from Earth to the Moon. And then there was some processing period on the Moon, and then we boarded a much larger transport that I would – it was multiple levels, and we were on one level, and I would just have to guess at maybe the levels and how many people total. But I would say it was, you know, between 2,500, maybe 4,000, 5,000 max personnel that they crammed on that thing, and then – used a larger sort of wormhole generator to move that ship from lunar orbit to Mars in a pretty short period of time, maybe 15-20 minute flight or something like that altogether.
Wow. And was it equally balanced between men and women? Because so thus far more male clients have been reporting this similar story to yours, Randy, but there must have been women involved as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And I would have to say that in my general accounting of that, trying to figure out, you know, what the breakdowns were, all the way from training as a child to training of other programs coming together as a teenager and finalized assignments as an adult, it really seemed to break down about 75-25. So about three quarters of the numbers were male and about a quarter to a third were female.
Okay, well, that makes sense. And when you were actually at some point able to fly craft, I suppose either shuttlecraft or military incursion craft or whatever, were there neural interfaces with this craft? Were your upgrades or your genetic preparation designed to allow you to be able to pilot sophisticated neural interface craft?
Yes and no. We sort of, I mean, there are some implants, I suppose, that facilitate that. And then we would wear, I mean, there was a helmet that I really felt like was doing most of the interfacing, to be honest, but I suppose there has to be sort of a two-way, system to make sure that you're communicating with that solidly. But I'm not sure how, knowing sort of how those amplifiers, sort of psionic amplifiers work, you don't necessarily need implants inside someone's brain to make them work. You can really just have, you know, this kind of helmet or thing that connects over their head that can connect them up. But there are, from what I understand, some other vehicles that are mostly psionic interface only, and if you don't have a certain threshold of psionic ability, then you would need the implant for them. And I guess the training was really pretty broad spectrum. We were really trained to fly just about anything, and so I think it would go hand in hand that, yeah, there's some implants in there for piloting that, so we can not just fly our own ships, but we can fly a variety of other people's ships if we need to as well.
Fascinating. And when you were stationed on Mars as a Mars defense part of the Mars defense team, now I believe that you mentioned that there were several indigenous beings to Mars that were reptoid, and there were I think you mentioned three major groups, possibly more. Now, during your time on Mars, did you see evidence either archaeological or otherwise of earlier sophisticated cultures or that may have lived on the surface of the planet before some destruction?
Oh, yeah, no question. No question at all. I would have to say one of the stranger things to ever encounter was moving across a desert plateau and seeing you know, at a distance, what seemed to be sort of a tall, narrow kind of rock outcropping. But as you got closer and closer, realizing that it was the metal frame of a structure, like basically if the girders of a building of maybe a 50 or 60 story building were still standing, but you know, all the concrete and everything else had just been wasted away. So you still had probably three quarters of the corners and the sides that were still connected, and the other quarter that was mostly disconnected and disintegrated by that point. So it was at least 75% of the base was still intact and the structure was still intact, to recognize that that was a metal girdered building, you know, that was now just rusted girders barely standing. So yeah, that was pretty interesting. And there were certainly some other things that I would say, you know, were more timeless. Like, you just couldn't say how old certain stone structures or structures that were made of stone or had stone, you know, exteriors or interiors that were clearly built, how long or old, you know, without having some technology. But seeing an old, like, frame of a skyscraper that had, you know, was just barely standing there anymore, that's pretty interesting. That was pretty telling, you know, if I can say that. That was pretty telling that something had been there a very, very long time ago that was, what we would consider a civilized city,
yeah,
comparable to something that we would make or build.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And these reptoids that were in different, I suppose, pods or nests, Was your
other communities? They have very, very civilized communities. So I wouldn't resort them to that level of animalism. I think that they had very, very organized civilized communities. And in fact I think that their level of understanding of technology is quite advanced. And I think that they had some things tucked away that were quite advanced. But they really chose, post the destruction of their surface of the planet, to live really closer, you know, down to the earth, so to speak. Very more like agrarian based, like let's go back to being farmers and living off the land kind of a thing than building weapons of mass destruction and giant buildings on the surface. I think that was really their focus. But I think their ability to still understand technology is quite vast. Now, there are other tribes, we can sort of call them tribes at some point, that have chosen maybe less so, and to go away from, steer away from technology. Sort of the southern tribes are more like that, and that can get a little more uncivilized, so as it were.
Mm-hmm. And do these reptoid beings, with especially the ones with the handle on technology, do they leave Mars on their own volition if they wish to, or are they really, you know, planetary based?
My understanding is that those who have remained and have taken responsibility for themselves and their planet, basically are terraforming, you know. So part of the reason the planet is bounced back isn't just nature. Some of it is, you know, the active assistance of slow terraforming on the surface by the indigenous folks who want to try and see it be a lush planet again with oceans and rivers and lakes and streams like it used to be. So that's been part of their slow process to rebuild their planet. And I think that their viewpoint is, we're not going anywhere until we fix the mess that we made. So they have the capability, I believe. I just don't think that they're acting on it in any way, shape, or form, because they believe that their responsibility is to fix their mess first,
Oh, wow.
To clean up their mess.
How refreshing is that?
Well, an interesting point of that is that at the time of the destruction, all that was left was the underground cities and communities. And so my understanding is there was a split, and the split was those who were like, see ya, we're out of here, and those that were like, oh man, we really messed up, we have to stay and fix this. And so to say that those two factions, if they were to come together again, that it would be one big happy family is not even the case. Let's just say if those who left ever came back, they would not be welcomed with open arms. They would be greeted as traitors and abandoners and would be punished severely.
Randy, this is Wes speaking for a moment. I wanted to ask you a question that harkens back to an earlier point in this interview, and it's about telling family and friends. I've discovered over time that I'm a lifelong experiencer as well, and partly an abductee, and I have yet to disclose this to all of my family and friends. I've just been disclosing it to a select few, and even that process has been a process of nurturing over time. Would you say that one should feel compelled to tell one's family and friends?
No, because I think that that can be either helpful or harmful to someone's process and development through this, and that it really has to do, the individual has to understand their family and the people around them well enough to understand whether this is going to really be like a bad reaction or whether this is, you know, something that you can talk about. And I think that I certainly think you have to pick and choose who you talk about. And I think that if you feel like I got to talk to somebody, yeah, you're right, you got to talk to somebody. So in that sense, you got to find at least some person who you can be the friend, confidant, or other experiencer who lives on the other end of the planet, but you connected on the internet. As long as there's a person that you can communicate and unburden yourself with, I think that's healthy and necessary. But I think that, this is kind of like a coming out of the closet thing, and coming out of the space closet, you know, can be just as bad. You know, your friends and family might alienate you and not want to talk to you, and then you're that crazy person, and then you end up, you know, damaging, you know, relationships more than you wanted to try and mend or heal them. So I think that we are still riding this edge of, and what you say, like, you know, these are slow, nurturing conversations and relationships with people, because we haven't reached the point where, you know, we're talking about it on the 6 o'clock news yet. And that day's coming. And when that day comes, these conversations are going to change. So at the moment, we are still in maybe a delicate period where I would say if you're the brave type of person that feels like you want to unburden yourself and be a brave person and not care about what people's opinions and response may be to your being in your truth and in who you are and your strength, do that. Absolutely do that. If you feel like you would destabilize your healing process by unburdening yourself to everyone, that it would be an overwhelming thing that would, you know, annihilate your ability to regain your health and your wellness, then don't do it, because, you know, you need to understand where you are in that. Do you feel like you're strong and ready enough to take it on, or you really feel like you need to heal quietly and slowly? Then that really depends on what you know, what approach you want to take. So I don't think anybody should feel compelled. I think they should feel ready. So when they feel ready to talk about it, when they feel ready to tell everybody, then absolutely. And I think that, again, we're going to come to a point when more and more and more and more people are talking about it, and we're not just going to be talking about it in what I will refer to lovingly, but I think honestly, is the fringe media. Mm-hmm. When the mainstream 6 o'clock news and everybody else is talking about it, and they will, there just has to become this point of, oh, it's okay now, everybody, we can talk about it, you know. And it's when, you know, when the Pope and the President and somebody else have a conversation about it at the table, or, you know, there's what I call the Rose Garden announcement, or we have, you know, something sticking out of the Statue of Liberty one morning and everyone tweets it around the world in 5 minutes, and you can't just say, oh, no, that's just a weather balloon, when it's clearly, you know, a smoldering spaceship sticking out of the Statue of Liberty's head. There are these things that will happen that will tip the scale, where you will no longer have these arguments about, yes, it is, no, it isn't, yes, it is, no, it isn't, because now we'll be, see, I told you, yes, it is, because you'll have that just enough level of official admission that we can start having the conversation about, okay, now we don't have to have the conversation of, yes, it is, no, it isn't, yes, it is, no, it isn't. Now we can explain that it is and how it is and why it is, and get everyone to just come along, you know, sort of slowly and sometimes grudgingly, but they'll do it. And look, some people, I'm going to bet you still, though, in 10 years after, you know, the moment of disclosure, will still be parading around, it's a hoax, it's all a hoax. There will still be a minority of people who will be saying that. But you know what? 95% of the rest of the population will be in tune and on the page and be moving into the future. So, you know, even if we have a very reluctant group of people that's a tiny percentage over years and years who still don't want to deal with it, whatever. We're going to get to almost mostly everybody, and that's what's going to move civilization down the road.
Yes.
Thank you for that, Randy. That's an excellent answer, and I would say in the bizarre world of abductions and experiences, I'm prudent.
That's right. You are an icon of prudism.
I was too. I wouldn't look. I kept this really, really. Look, before I went public, I could count on both hands, you know, the number of people in my world who knew this about me that I had talked to. I mean, there were less than 10 people in the entire world who I had, you know, had a conversation that, you know, about sort of this was going on in my world and my life, and this is what I was dealing with. So it was a very, very, very tiny, you know, circle of people that I was having disclosure moments with, personal disclosures. And it wasn't until, oh, you want to tell everybody, that I said, okay, and telling, I will say this, though, that for anyone who is on the edge of considering, like, do I really want to tell the whole world? Do I want to start my own internet blog and do an interview with somebody and, like, really just go out there and do it? Look, if you really feel like now is the time that you want to truly unburden, like, yourself of all the weight that you feel in the world and you want to feel to be the most liberated human being that you can, then do it. Because I will absolutely say without question that talking about this again and again and again and over and over and over and essentially shouting from the rooftops has liberated me in a way that I could never have anticipated or expected. But believe me when I say that I am overjoyed that I have been liberated in that sense, because it has made so many other aspects of the way my mind, my body, my emotions, and my entire being interact with my life that it's worth more than, you know, my entire body in gold would be. Or I mean, there's no value I can put on that level of liberation of being able to just come out of the space closet.
Yeah.
And I can just say that if you're really on that edge of that place, do it, because you will find a point of personal liberation no matter what anybody else thinks or says. You will find a point of personal liberation that will put you in a better place as a human being, and you'll just live a better life, and you'll just have a better life, and you'll just be happier with yourself, and that's what will matter.
Okay.
And you can also be pleasantly surprised, I think, sometimes when you begin sharing these experiences with individuals and a percentage of them say, well, I never told you, but I've had experiences as well. Because I think we do, in a sense, in the way we incarnate in groups, I think our circles are probably full of people who have had experiences.
Yes, thank you so much for bringing that up, because let me definitely interject. The minute that I started saying, you know, this is my life, was the minute that I started getting tons of feedback from people going, well, here's what happened to me, here's my thing, and random strangers, of course, who had heard of me that I never met or talked to, as well as people who knew me who were like, well, you know, or I have a friend, or my sister says, or, you know, I mean, yeah, it was always, you are surprised to see that this has touched everybody's lives on planet Earth, just about when you think about somebody can say, oh, yeah, I had a boyfriend, a girlfriend, a partner, a sister, a brother, somebody I knew, or I had an experience, or I saw something that I could never explain. There, everyone does have a story, even if it's a Sasquatch story, even if it's, you know, I saw a Sasquatch in the woods once, and I didn't know what to mean about that, because my understanding that, you know, those are also very likely to be a extraterrestrial being that's not originally from here, but has been here long enough now that they're a long-time family resident.
Indeed.
And family.
Yeah,
the Enkidu. I think you're right, though, just to say that you, sometimes you will be very pleasantly surprised to realize that you're not the only one, but, you know, speaking up will get other people the opportunity to say, oh, yeah, me too, or something that will help.
Indeed it will. And if we could, I just wanted to go, while we still have some time here, I just wanted to go back, if we could, to the Mars experience. And now, if this is disturbing, Randy, we do not have to discuss it at all, but I know that there was a military event that you were involved with where you entered a nest of reptoids, and there were some disastrous consequences, and I believe that really marked maybe the end of your military tour of duty?
Yeah, that was the end of my time in the Mars Defense Force, and essentially my commanding officer after that event while I was recovering in the hospital asked me if I wanted to fly, if I wanted to go to flight school, and I didn't have to think twice. That was a hell yeah. And so it was a life-shattering event that I can say if I had not had the opportunity to just go somewhere different and do something completely different, I don't think I could have picked myself up from that. I think that being offered the opportunity to go somewhere else, be something else, basically I was going to also be going from an enlisted person to being an officer. I mean, my whole life changed overnight, you know, when my entire division was decimated, and then, you know, 3 days later, I'm, you know, in a medical wing on another planetary body waiting for, you know, clearance so I can start flight school. And my entire and while I'm looking at my officer's commission, and all of a sudden people are calling me sir, and it's a whole nother universe. Like, yeah, it's just it was a night and day shift that allowed me to move on. You know, because if I had had just to stop or go back and do the same thing or be in the same place, or I don't know how I could have dealt with it. So it absolutely was a coping mechanism to be able to go somewhere and do something else. But yeah, that was the end of my time in the MDF. Mm-hmm. And then I got fully moved into the Radiant Guardian fleet and was in the EDF from that point on. And just, it was just a whole nother world. It's a whole nother world.
Yeah. And Randy, what do you think when you, you know, look at yourself as a human being? Are you aware of the aspects of yourself that were either, you know, tweaked up or enhanced? Do you have, I would imagine, are you able to, you know, remote view, or do you have telepathic experiences? What was kind of the nature of these upgrades that made you the perfect guy?
Well, it's certainly an ever-growing process of understanding as I, now that I have free access to all of that stuff, the ability to, in meditative states, in deep state states, to get at all that information and kind of look through the handbooks and the manuals and go, oh, I can do that. That's cool. Oh, wouldn't have thought about that. And so some of that is a really interesting process to see, and to see the minutia that was put into it. So it's not just broad strokes that they use to try and build me. They really put a lot of meticulous thought into the very, very tiny details of how everything works and how it was programmed and trained. So as I continue to learn and understand what all of that is and what all my special abilities are, it's fascinating. It's a fascinating process. And it's kind of like, you know, I've heard people say, like, you know, you don't come with an instruction manual. Well, this is kind of like all of a sudden getting your instruction manual and going through and going, wow, I didn't know I had power windows, you know, and just kind of getting really excited about all these little features that you didn't really know that you had. And as well as the ones that you know that you had in your, you know, you now you can sort of look at the specs and so forth, and it's very fascinating. So, I mean, I'm definitely designed to be a better, stronger, faster physical tactical machine. My tactical brain is designed to calculate more vectors and more factors spatially and temporally faster than other people are supposed to be able to do. And certainly I'm supposed to have, you know, heightened psionic abilities. And so, yeah, certainly my remote viewing ability is pretty good. I have other people who I sort of consider and act as my remote viewers when I need something like to be really accurate or for cases that I'm investigating. So I consider that sometimes that my own ability is a good vector starter, and it gives me good indicators of things. But if I want to be really specific about something, then I will ask someone else who's better at it. But I think, like anything else, if I practiced more and I really wanted to really like be like the best remote viewer I could be, I'm sure I could get way better at it. But to be honest, there are just other skills that I think are more important for me to focus on at the moment. So Yeah, I mean, I certainly the command staff and the entire unit at the moment of United States Marine Corps Special Section operates as a psionic command, as a psionic unit. So we have implants that connect us psionically to a large psionic computer so that we all have sort of enhanced psionic communication and sort of ability with one another. That's interesting. And what else? So when I was a pilot, that was when I got the temporal implant. Now, the temporal implant is an implant that essentially houses next to your pineal gland so that you get the enhanced ability to see through time just about a minute or two when you're flying through space. Because when you're flying through space, there is no scanning system that will see objects approaching or something that you're going to collide with fast enough. There's just no way to the speeds that you're going, you don't get, you know, like electronic feedback fast enough. So you have to use your own temporal sensor to actually look a couple minutes into the future. And if you see that you're going to collide or hit with something, then you just like move left or right. And then like you can see that you're not going to hit it and you're fine. So you're kind of just using this minor ability to see in the future, just a very short distance in order to not run into stuff.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. That's how the ETs do it too. They either have to have their own developed sense or a psionic amplifier. That's how they're doing it. They're just looking through time a couple minutes ahead so you don't crash into things.
Oh boy. Well, that certainly makes an awful lot of sense, doesn't it? And one thing I did want to ask you, Randy, that I've been kind of wondering about now. And again, this points to maybe a more like right now, here and now, how you're going to take this gestalt of experience and get your message. Because I also think that along with these other enhanced abilities that you mentioned, you are an enhanced communicator. And that can't be an accident. That cannot be an accident. You have a really, because I've listened to you in a lot of radio programs, you know, from coast to coast to all the little internet things and Carrie Cassidy. You have a unique ability to convey your ideas in a succinct and direct way, and that is a rare ability. And it seems to me that part of this whole thing here is this now wonderful denouement where you are utilizing this maybe a latent ability to be a natural communicator, the kind of person that can communicate to a blue-collar guy below the Mason-Dixon line and to a Harvard professor. And now that's my impression of how you are able to communicate the way you are, that it cuts through all boundaries, and you're here at a specific time to do a specific thing, which maybe could have even been put into place, you know, in the interlife before you ever even arrived here on the earthly plane. But are you in touch, Randy, with what a good communicator you are, and that too might be in the package?
Yeah, I get good feedback on that. So I think that that's a classic case of relativity, where your own sense of relativity about where you are or how you are about something is your own normal. So when I think of myself as a communicator, I certainly don't think of myself as any kind of an amazing communicator. I think of myself as a completely normal communicator. So if people have a lesser communicative ability, I just think that people have a hard time communicating. And then I certainly look up to people who I think have better communication skills than I do. So, wow, he really knows how to talk to people. But I appreciate that feedback, and I'll just say this, that one of the smartest people I ever knew, and someone who was very smart about the human experience, said that you get good at whatever you practice, and that means anything. If you complain all the time, you're going to become the master complainer. You're going to get really good at it because you're practicing all the time. And if you're a can-do problem solver, you're going to, you know, get good at that because that's what you're going to be doing all the time, is, you know, I can do problem solve. So I think that my entire life, I have had a sense that communication is important. How you say something's important, whether people, and not just how you say something, but whether or not someone's hearing you. And I think that I learned at a very young age that you can say something really clear and people will still not even hear you if you're not saying it in a way that they can understand. So I think what I've endeavored to do my entire life is try to learn how to translate what's happening up here in my head as far as how I want to communicate an idea, thought, or a subject or whatever, and how to communicate that using, you know, words, phrasing, body language, terminology to a person or group of people that are going to understand it. And so if that means I'm a good communicator, then okay, I guess I'm a good communicator. So I'm, you know, yay me then. I guess the other way to answer that question is, I think over time, as I have been doing lots of talking and I have gotten lots of feedback from people who, you know, and all the really positive slaps on the back that I get from everybody are wonderful, but it's not the same as when someone who really, 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 really knows about something or really, really has a qualification sort of in their own field, that when that person says good job, you know, you can feel like, oh, I really did a good job because someone who really knows a lot, who could judge me on 19 different things, you know, thinks I did a good job. So in some ways, the feedback that I've gotten from people who I really respect as, you know, saying, wow, you're a really good communicator. And I'm like, wow, really? You think I'm a really good communicator? So I do have stopped to think a few times, well, okay, I guess they did pick the right guy because I can communicate. And then, yeah, my understanding of how my engineering process goes, how the ability for them to sort of see through time space in that process as well, so they're not just at a blueprint drawing board space, they're doing that blueprint in that drawing board space and also looking into the future to see how it works out at the same time. So if that, and that twists my noodle, but if that's all true, as I understand, as it's been told me that it is, then that means that there are people who were engineering and planning my life who were looking ahead and seeing how my life was going to go from the very design phase, in which case, yeah, I mean, if you're saying, no, tweak that there. Oh, no, look, that improved his communication abilities 45 years down the road. Okay, I mean, if that's the level of tinkering that you're able to do, and I think that they were able to do that, then no, it's probably not an accident then. It's probably a lot of really precise tinkering, you know, people who were observing those details and watching how it was having an impact or an outcome. So,
well,
I try.
As Freud says, there are no accidents. So we're just going to go with that. And Randy, now I know your first book is coming out very shortly, and we just have a couple of minutes here. I did want to mention that. And what is the best way?
I wouldn't say that it's coming out very shortly. The book is a bunch of words that I've typed into a bunch of different portions, and the first chance that I get to really dedicate time to sorting all of that out, it will get done. The severity of other things that are on my desk that carry a weight of importance that is far greater than finishing my book at the moment seems to be what's at the top of my agenda. What is the very, very next thing is I was asked to do some public speaking engagements, and when I decided to do them, I spoke to my brigadier and said, what should I talk about? Because I don't want to just get up there and talk about me, I did this. That's horrible. I don't want to do that. And he said, well, what do you think people need to know more than anything? And I was just like, well, psionic skills probably. And he was like, great, teach that, teach laws of psionics and psionic self-defense and military psionic protocol. And I went, what? And so I did a little lecture on that and a workshop on that at East City Ranch up in Washington in the first weekend of July. It went so well that we're doing a full weekend that I'm calling Psionic Boot Camp, the 25th to the 27th of this month. I'm going back up there to East City Ranch in Washington, James Gilliland's place,
yeah.
And we're going to do that again. And so we're hoping that we're going to do be able to video and make up a video and a DVD of it so that we can – so really before I do a book, I will have a produced video on the laws of psionics, psionic self-defense, and military psionic protocol. And then, you know, next year, maybe springtime, maybe I'll have my book done. I don't know. I will say this. When I finish it, the first thing I'm going to do is I will self-publish as an ebook, and so people who have that as an option to read it will have the first option to read it.
Great.
And then we'll see about who wants to do or what we're going to do about paper publishing options, because I still think that paper books are a good thing. I still have paper books. I like to read paper books.
Oh, yeah. I've still got 8-track tapes, Randy.
Wow. You just
they were here while you were gone. Anyway, if folks want to get in touch with you, Randy, what's the best way to interface with you?
People go to my website, which also has links to all my interviews and a bunch of other stuff, and it's earthcitizenconsulting, all one word, .org. We also have the .com site, so if you enter in Earth Citizen Consulting, that'll get you there.
All right. Well, Captain Randy Kramer, Captain K, we cannot thank you enough for joining us this evening on Contact. It's been a totally enervating, fascinating conversation, and I hope that you will come back and visit us real soon.
It has been my pleasure. Thanks for having me. Semper Fi.
Okay. Thank you, Randy. Live long and prosper.
Absolutely.